3, 2, 1. Well, hi, listeners. Today you're very privileged to have an amazing lady who is on the cutting edge of toxins and toxins during vaccines and phthalates, which I understand is the very latest scary thing to be on the toxic horizon. And she's here today from Missouri. And her name is Kathy Keithley Johnson, and quite a remarkable lady. She has a fantastic website, and we'll give you all the details of that at the end of the show. But today, Kathy is with us, and she's going to be telling us how she came to be in the toxic business and why she set up this organization and this very important website. The name of her organization is called Toxic Discovery Network, and she operates out of Columbia, Missouri. Hello, Kathy.
Hello, Elaine, and to all your listeners.
That's right, here in Victoria. Now, Kathy, you were poisoned by silicone breast implants, just like I was, right?
Absolutely, Elaine.
Okay, so you had leaking, ruptured breast implants for a number of years, and you became very sick.
That's literally what started my journey into the organization that I'm now the medical director of and being an advocate in the issue across the board against toxins, yes.
So on your long journey to get to the truth, you have sort of been digging up all kinds of things that you feel compelled to let the public know about, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, as I mentioned to you, that certainly it's whatever the chemical of the day is. And I think that I was truly blessed in my life for several reasons to understand that. My background even mirrors today what I do professionally. I was originally a operating room nurse as a registered nurse, and then I ventured out into hematology oncology and became a director specializing in chemotherapy for almost 16 years. I did that and happened to be married to an environmental geologist, a scientist who knows about toxins in our air, in our dirt, and in our earth. And so interesting enough, my life and his and what we do today professionally mirrors what has brought me to this today from really being injured.
That's right. Well, listeners, you know, we are going to sort of rock your socks off today, I hope, with an amazing revelation. I think you will be absolutely amazed when we reveal this to you, when Kathy and I reveal it. Now, I think I'm lifting this from someone else. I'm plagiarizing this, Kathy, but it was put so well, so I'm stealing it. It's from your website, actually.
Oh. Okay.
I forget whose quote it is, but I thought it was very appropriate. And here it is. There's a big disconnect between the products we purchase in our lives and how they are made. We need to stop pretending that we are being exposed to one chemical from one source at a time. We need to recognize how exposures from many products may be adding up to harm.
Absolutely.
Isn't that well put? So you
Absolutely.
Can see where I lifted it. Now, Kathy and I are silicone survivors. I mean, you've obviously regained your health somewhat, Kathy. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to be on this mission, right?
Well, somewhat. Basically, I don't discuss that much because being an advocate and being on the go and what I do, but certainly I remain on medications from connective tissue diseases to be able to function. But I've been able to take a lot of the other toxins out of my life very naturally, you know, been treated by every doctor around the world almost. But by understanding what we need to get well and how that needs to be done, I have been very, very blessed in life. Not 100% back, Elaine, but certainly back with energy to be able to do what I do and certainly to be able to pass that information on to others.
That's right. So we're hoping to be able to speak to Kathy a few more times about quite a few different topics. But today we're going to tell you about her new mission quest, as it were, and that's to help, to try and help the children who have been severely damaged by being exposed to silicon compounds whilst they're in utero or being breastfed by mothers who had leaking silicon breast implants. Now, I had two children whilst I was suffering from silicosis, is that what you call it, Kathy?
Silicosis. Right, is the correct terminology.
And fortunately, at the moment, my children are healthy. But the more I read about how devastating the silicon compounds can be and the latency aspect, I have great fears that, you know, they may be affected later on in their lives. So it's a real worry for me. I mean, that's why I thought it was important that to bring Kathy on the show. Now, you took over this job, didn't you, of helping these children from another lady who has worked behind the scenes for many years.
Absolutely. Jay Marusano, who is the founder and president of CATS, Children Afflicted with Toxic Substances. Jema, I cannot say enough about. A mother, a true advocate, did not have a medical background, but certainly mirrors in her education in what she is doing. And interesting enough, Elaine, like the two of us, Jema was also a recipient of silicone gel breast implants and have three children that have suffered a plethora of medical problems that she believes, and certainly many of us believe, are directly related to her breast implants and the toxins that were in them.
So can you enlighten the listeners, what sort of medical problems do these children encounter?
Absolutely, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to preface a little bit about, to lead into that, what Toxic Discovery is, if you don't mind.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
Toxic Discovery Network is an international not-for-profit consumer protection organization. And basically our primary focus is on chemical injury, but interesting enough, medical device failure associated with all silicone medical devices, but especially breast implants. We get calls, we have a database of over 25,000 injured consumers, so we're not just a little support group. We don't view ourselves as that any longer. We used to be, and we built on that database so very, very quickly. That's how Jay Marusano and myself and many, many other instrumental women and advocates and men in this issue that we came together, because we get calls concerning everything from penile implants, testicular implants, hydrocephalic shunts, pacemakers, knee implants, chin implants, cheek implants. It just goes on and on. And interesting enough, Elaine, in doing what we've done for the past 10 years, we have seen, our organization has seen, very much an interesting occurrence is that not just breast implants mirror these same types of problems. And when you do research on PubMed or any of the medical journals, you will see case after case of health-related issues that mirror what you and I personally have endured. And that's what brought us into forming what we called at the time a children's issue to work hand-in-hand with Jay Marusano and CATS, called Toxic to Kids. And what we were going to do, we were not just going to be about breast implants or silicone specifically, and neither was Jay Marusano's group, of course. And that's how we together were brought together. Jema has been a professional speaker for our organization over the years, numerous times at conferences that we have held throughout the United States. And we were very much impressed and wanted to be able to help. We've done fundraisers for her organization in trying to raise money to study the children. We certainly feel that the children, of course, are our legacy, and the mothers, what I find so heart-wrenching, my own son, I received my breast implants 14 months after my son was born, and so my son, there for the grace of God go I. I did not breastfeed any longer after I had breast implants, and my son was certainly not affected in utero, and so there was no problems. But that didn't make our organization less concerned. And when we get calls from mothers basically when we're talking with them, Elaine, what you will see, and I'm sure you can confirm this very statement, is the mothers are not so concerned about themselves. What happens is all they can talk about and all the guilt that is laid on them from here on out is they feel so guilty of, and they will say, look what I have done to my child. And we do not feel that, you know, the mothers did this whatsoever, for the simple fact the mothers were not educated, the mothers were not told by the doctors, the mothers were not told by the manufacturers that this could cross across the placenta, this could be in breast milk. And one of the most famous studies is a Scandinavian study that was in ACTA that we do carry a large volume showing that it was in breast milk and the problems that it was passed on. And so we do see symptomology that mirrors what the mothers endure. We see everything from esophageal dysmobilities, which is, you know, problems with being able to swallow, or they will, those babies will spit up a lot. Not just like what normal babies spit up, but that it will be projectile vomiting. They will have problems digesting their milk. Allergies reflected all types of problems. And JAMA had been studying, interesting enough, some problems with the males, the offspring of everything from infertility problems, problems with smaller testes in little boys. Hormonal, we do know today that part of the toxins that were in the silicone gel or this silicone soup du jour that these manufacturers made up for these implants that contain so many toxins and so many different chemicals that without testing specifically the implant that went in the woman, we just, you know, do not see, or what we see is a different process in these children, but it certainly mirrors what the mothers, especially lupus in newborns. We see lupus. We see a positive anti-nuclear antibodies, which is ANA, showing that their body is fighting themselves, even in their blood work. So this is a very scary thing. And so we did loop arms with the CATS program and with Ms. Russano, and we now are in the process. JAMA is not retiring. She's going to serve on our board, but Toxic Discovery Network is inheriting CATS, and we are in the process of starting to raise funds to form the board for the children's groups, and it will be nationally. We know our sisters all over the world. This is a concern for what they're doing. We need grant money. We need to look at these children. We need to stop being spoon-fed by the manufacturers, by the physicians, by everyone else that our children and that our breast implants did not cause problems.
Well, just to interject there, today we want to welcome Mr. Pierre Blais, Dr. Pierre Blais, who is residing in Ottawa at this time. Hello,
yes.
Pierre.
Hi.
Today we've got a very, I think, an exciting show for you. As you know, here at the university, we're very, everywhere, everyone is concerned about the power that global corporations seem to have been given. We're all very concerned that there is nothing to keep them in check, and that we as consumers have absolutely no protection from their bad, poisonous products. And we don't appear to have any government ministries with enough teeth or bite or whatever to go after the corporations on the public's behalf and rein them in and make sure that they don't dump bad products into the Canadian market. And especially, I would say, drugs and medical devices, because that really is where the public is perhaps most vulnerable. Now, Pierre, when he was in all his glory, was the head scientist, right, Pierre?
Yes.
At the Health Protection Branch of Health Canada. And he was a loyal gatekeeper. He was a whistleblower. He was the canary that sang on such issues as tainted blood and bad medical devices. Now, when I say medical devices, I mean
all kinds of different devices. But I would like to home in on one particular thing, which is the breast implants. Pierre, I'd like to begin today to sort of go back, if we can go back in time, to when you first took a position at the Health Protection Branch. Now, when you first worked there, which I think was in, what, the mid-1970s?
Well, I worked there from the mid-70s up to almost 1990 to the day.
Right. Now, when you started work, the mandate for the Health Protection Branch and the Ministry of Health and Welfare was to protect Canadians from dangerous drugs and medical devices. And in order to do that, you had quite an efficient system set up, didn't you, Pierre?
Well, it's not a matter of a system. It's a philosophy. It's a directive from the Parliament. The Parliament essentially dictated that there would be an agency responsible for protecting the public from faulty technologies, faulty healthcare technologies, and from false promotion of certain types of medical mm-hmm. procedures
so
or
medical
products. So essentially
then, if it had worked as it was supposed to, then Canadians would have had protection from bad medical devices and bad drugs, yes?
That is correct up to the limit of what is feasible. Whereas the will, or rather the wish, to perform this service was dictated by Parliament, it then also fell back on Parliament to allocate funds to achieve this to the limit that it could afford. Every year, as part of budgetary forecast, a certain amount of money would be earmarked to various programs, one of which was the protection of the public from healthcare technologies. And this is, to a certain degree, what was the variability, the difference between the wish and what could be done.
Right.
Some years were very good, and it was a situation where problems could be addressed within the budgetary constraints. Other years, the budgeting was very bad, and everything sort of fell a little bit short of the mandate, but the wish was there at the time.
So when was the time when you sort of thought, hello, why did you suddenly think that the breast implants were not safe?
I knew this from the beginning, and so did everyone who had a certain amount of intimacy with the sector. The devices accounted for an enormous fraction of adverse reactions that were being treated at the public expense. For example, in the late 70s, a study was performed by accessing health insurance disbursement records for two large metropolitan centers, and enormous fractions of redos, that is, surgery done over again because the first one backfired, were performed. In fact, one city showed more redos than what was actually likely to be even a failure rate of 50%. In other words, nearly everybody who had the procedure wound up back in surgery and at the public's expense at that. And so we knew of this. I certainly knew of this very early on, but I didn't know why until about 1977, 78, when the reasons became fairly obvious.
So you feel that you were just doing your job and forwarding the mandate of the Health Protection Branch when you went to your superiors and said, look, I don't think these breast implants are safe, and I think they should be taken off the market, and we should hire consultants to test them for us under various conditions to see if they are safe. Is that what happened?
Not quite. What happened, we knew the products were poor. We knew also that, on average, they didn't work. This is well established, and it's well documented in the literature that predates 1975. What we went after is to try and change the Canadian regulations to ensure that some degree of control could be maintained over the product so as to keep the level of adverse effects to the minimum. And to do that, it could be done very easily by changing the regulations, by making the devices subject to pre-market review. Prior to 1983, we could not essentially deflect a product which we knew was faulty from being marketed, at least for a while.
So there was no testing or no review of the breast implants until
there
that point.
There still isn't. There never was.
There still isn't. There never was.
Even before sale, and not as a criterion on whether or not they would be sold. It was purely a bureaucratic issue. But some of the products were so bad that even a cursory examination by a comparatively unsophisticated or inexperienced individual could figure out that the product was at best faulty and at worst fraudulent.
So who at the Health Protection Branch, you don't have to name a name, you can give the title instead if you prefer, or you can give their name. Was there any individual or group of individuals who directly opposed you and said, no, just shut up and we'll just keep
At the beginning when when the program got started, there was a lot of support and there was a collective attempt to at least protect the public to the limit of what could be done through budgetary and manpower allocation. In fact, the regulations were indeed changed as a result of intervention by a number of people, of which I was one. That was fine on paper, but there were other problems. The problems came at the level where the regulations would be implemented.
So what was done? I mean, did they hire the consultants to perform scientific research then?
Oh, it was more than a consultant. It was a laboratory that was tasked with collecting prostheses which were being removed for one reason or another, and to perform an analysis on the products to establish what had gone wrong, to also determine how carefully the devices were assembled, if they were logical, if what the company said they were was actually what they were. We call that consistency of product claims. And even within 1 year of that particular program, it became very obvious that the product was a class of its own, with extremely poor levels of sophistication and essentially far greater risks than even I had imagined at the beginning.
So why weren't the breast implants removed from the marketplace before 91? I believe that's the date.
Because it was taught that the regulations could do that on their own. And there was another component within the decision chain which felt that there were people within Canada who would be willing to accept those products anyway, even if they knew of their risks. But this is called the stakeholder rule. According to views that were presented mostly by surgeons who were doing a lot of implantations, these people made a representation to the department to the effect that a lot of people wanted breast implants at any cost, and even if the implants were no good, they would still want the implants.
But they made that assumption then, so they didn't consider perhaps that they should have at least had informed consent.
No, it was more complex than that. The informed consent is only one aspect. Unlike Canada, unlike the U.S., Canada is a state-operated insurance program. And if that philosophy held true, that is, if anyone could do anything they jolly well wished, even in spite of risks, then there is no basis for these people to be insured by the collectivity of the other citizens. Otherwise, we would wind up in a situation where a teeny fraction of Canadians consume the totality of healthcare resources for frivolous purposes and leave nothing else for anybody else. And so the attitude was very simple. Whereas we acknowledge that there could be informed consent and that someone, though perhaps not fully cognizant of the risk, but nevertheless apprised of the risks, would accept the product, and this was fine with us, there was no basis for us to accept that this person would then tap into the healthcare system because she would run into predictable problems.
Now, what was the chain of command at that time, then, at the Health Protection Branch?
Well, the Health Protection Branch had a number of different clusters of people. We used to call them decision centers, who were responsible for implementing regulations, performing field investigations, that is, to see if what was really being sold was what we were told was being sold. And there was another group responsible for tracking information about the products. And these groups more or less worked independently until about certainly 1978, 79. And very often, not only did they work independently, but they worked according to different rules and different levels of knowledge. And there was very little, shall we say, concerted program which explains why the department ran into all kinds of problems.
But you see, obviously the department did have the political will and the ability to take the silicone breast implants off the market in 91, didn't they? So they must have had that ability beforehand, but they just didn't do it.
Well, oddly enough, they didn't do that. Although it appears that way, and there were claims in the media that the department had done just that, no such thing happened. Not to this day. What happened in 1991 is that one company ran into deep trouble in the U.S., and they were effectively demonstrated to have performed fraud against the U.S. government and the U.S. public.
And that company was?
The company in question was a subsidiary of a fairly large current drug firm, a company called Surgitech.
Which is Bristol-Myers Squibb, is it not?
Well, it's Bristol-Myers now, but it has a more complicated history than that. And it also involved more than that company. But still, that company encountered very serious difficulty with the U.S. counterpart of the Health Protection Branch.
The FDA.
The FDA. And as a result of the quarrel which subsequently evolved, the then commissioner of the FDA, competent and very sophisticated individual, in almost private contact with the company officials, threatened to do just that, threatened to ban their product from the marketplace. And not only that, but to do it noisily in a way that would really hurt their business. And the only way that they could get around it is by doing that themselves under conditions they could control.
Mm-hmm. I'd just like to interject here. I have actually read the annual report of Benoît Bouchard, who was the health minister in 91. I
think that's another story.
Annual report to the lieutenant governor, and it actually says there, verbatim, that the breast implants were removed to check for safety, which means they weren't checked beforehand, right?
No, they were not removed, and to this day, their safety was never evaluated.
And it still isn't.
And it still isn't.
Wow. Now, moving on a bit here, we're going to do a bit of a leap here. Now, I want you were, as I understand it, you were fired by the Health Protection Branch for insubordination in that you would not shred documents, important documents that you felt were important. You would not shred them when you were given the command to shred them. Is that right?
Well, that is one of the reasons. It's more complicated and more convoluted than that. But it is essentially a situation where an employee, myself, refuses the directives of a senior employee to destroy government property. In other words, it's damned if you do and damned if you don't. According to Canadian civil service regulations, you are deemed to have a complete and absolute allegiance to the chain of command, which embodies the so-called the wish of the minister, at least on paper. And that is that's an absolute directive. But at the same time, every individual within the civil service is deemed to be bound also by Canadian law. And a Canadian law forbids destruction of government property, or for that matter, anybody's property.
So did the health minister know that that you were being told and others were told to shred documents?
Well, that I don't know. That would have to be asked of him. And there were many health ministers, one after the other, who were hurt by this issue. I think ultimately the minister's office knew. I don't know whether the ministers, all three or four of them who cycled through the office, actually had a good grasp of the situation, because they were dependent on briefings that were prepared fairly deep within the department. And at the point where someone is caught doing something very wrong, then a lot of effort goes into covering up information. And the first person who you try to cover up information from is the minister. So in other words, employees of the Minister of Health were probably trying to either pull the wool over the minister's eye. But after a while, I'm sure any average person, including and in particular a minister, could certainly figure out what was going on. But it might have taken a while.
So what was the main reason, in your opinion, for the shredding? Now, was it because the documents were saying that there was scientific proof that the breast implants were very hazardous, or was it because the documents showed a certain collusion between big corporations who wanted their product left on the market at all cost, and also distributors of that product wanted the breast implants to remain on the Canadian market in spite of the fact that they were dangerous?
All of these factors applied.
So all three then? All three.
And some that you did not mention.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it boils down to simple dynamics of the way that government operations function, and it's not limited to Canada, but Canada is a good example because it is an organization where the civil service as a collectivity has far more power than elected bodies and elected individuals. In other words, a small group of relatively invisible individuals within the Canadian civil service actually control policies at all levels. They control, on one hand, corporations, and they control, on the other hand, elected officials. They act as middlemen, and in some cases, they're the ones who are responsible for whatever takes place. And it's not limited to breast implants. This takes place in defense procurement, in catastrophic situations such as redistribution of agricultural subsidies, drugs. It recurred again in connection with blood contamination and probably every other area, many of which I don't have intimate knowledge of, but I do have knowledge of the events through colleagues who were in situation.
So let's see if we can sort of encapsulate this sort of in a neat way so that our listeners can understand this. So what you're saying is basically that within all of these government departments, and for the purposes of this show, the Ministry of Health and the Health Protection Branch, there were, and still are, unfortunately, individuals who profit. Do they get paid off by corporations?
One would like to think so, but it's not so. And in the light of my experience, payment can occur in non-monetary ways. They can be in the form of parachutes, golden parachutes. They can be in the form of more discretionary power. It could be travel. It could be prestige. There are a lot of marketable commodities in government circles, and it's not always visible through classical accounting practice. To give you an example, civil servants are known to move back and forth between industry and government, and that's true for many countries. to give you an hypothetical situation, someone who is on one year in a position of influence in government may not have his job very stable in government. So it is nice for him to have an understanding that if things go very bad and if he gets fired, he will have a place to go, and chances are pretty good that it's going to be the industry that he was interacting with.
So jobs for the boys.
This is called a golden parachute situation in reverse. It's not a monetary cash out. It's simply an assurance from whoever you have helped outside of your office of employment that if something goes bad, that they will save you, so to speak. They will give you a safety raft.
Would you say, Pierre, that an agent such as Réal Lapetière was one of these types of people?
Well, the Réal Lapetière is an organization.
Lapetière, sorry.
It's pronounced Lapetière. This is
a
very long story, and it's not just an individual. Although this is the name of an individual, there's enough to write a small novel.
Well, was he? Would you say he was very pivotal in the breast implant scandal?
Yes and no. He was substantially different from many others that I had seen because of the concentration of his powers. Amongst the what we call business or the business stakeholders, the organization known as Réal Lapetière Enterprises had officials even within the riding association of local ministers.
Like who?
Amongst them, the Minister of the Environment, who was active between 1984 through to 1988, whose name was Grenier. It was a lady environment minister.
Wasn't that the riding that Brian Mulroney ran for?
No, it wasn't. It was a riding that was held by progressive conservatives during the Mulroney terms. There were two Mulroney terms. The first minister...
So it was a key riding then?
There were several ridings involved, but the one that Mr. Mulroney ran in was not directly involved. It would have been too embarrassing if it had been. There were others. These basically, those ridings produced MPs who subsequently transferred to the Bloc Québécois when the Conservative Party vanished.
What was Pierre Lapetière then? He was the head of that electoral.
Now, the chief executive for the Réal Lapetière Enterprises was a very long-term riding association president who survived two ministers and, in a way, was a kind of kingmaker. He decided as who would be elected, in a way, and he also decided who would become a minister.
So this Perrier fellow had an incredible amount of power then.
Yes, and it was not necessarily monetary. It was what we call a power through being at a gateway.
Right.
He controlled a flow of traffic.
He also controlled the flow of all the breast implants, well, nearly all of them, into Canada, did he not?
Well, at one time, he sold breast implants for nearly everybody in Canada between 1978, almost, right up to, well, he's still around.
Yes.
And he's still marketing for yet another company. Anyway, but to make a long story short, this organization is not, even though it has the same name, it went through numerous evolutionary cycles, some of which are really quite comical. Others are very embarrassing, and yet others are very quintessential to what we call the progressive conservative years, where everything was for sale, or as it was termed in the media, where Canada was, quote, open for business, unquote. Whatever that was supposed to mean, we in government had to interpret. Ultimately, what it really meant is that everything had a price. including government officials and decisions about public safety.
So it would seem then that certain individuals placed within the health protection branch had their own reasons for making sure that the breast implants stayed on the market.
Oh, there were many people, and many of them acted on behalf of organizations that they belonged to. Others acted out of fear. Others were probably remunerated in tangible and intangible ways. Some bailed out of government, indeed, and resurfaced within some of these organizations. There were as many reasons as there were individuals, but all of them were certainly of marginal ethics, and they were the kind of thing that you don't really like to put in your professional resume at the end of the year.
Well, just to interject there, I mean, Dow Chemical, which of course was responsible for a lot of this debacle, in my opinion, I mean, when it was doing all its testing of the silicon and all its experimentation, you know, with various compounds and different forms that it takes, you know, silicon rubber, liquid, gel, whatever, I mean, they actually they knew that this stuff was very toxic and very immunogenic back in the 50s, and they just went ahead, you know, and just lied about their product and concealed those things. And I mean, I know that there was a sterility compound. You're talking about the male offspring having underdeveloped sexual organs. Well, you know, it was patented as a sterility compound, right?
Right.
It was patented. And it was also a very effective insecticide. In fact, so darn effective, they couldn't market it because it was too toxic.
Yeah, it was too good. Absolutely.
Yeah, and and they also. I know these things because I got the depositions from a case that Dow Chemical lost, actually, in Louisiana. And, I mean, there it is in black and white, you know, that they even noted that this stuff would make a great chemical weapon because it was absorbed so readily through the pores in the skin.
Well, and that's right. And one of the things I know that Ms. Russano has always pointed out with Dow Corning is that they never tested or evaluated the silicone gel and breast implants to determine whether or not it would have any adverse effects on infants. And that's amazing to me, is how stupid can that be, for the simple fact if you're going to put something in a woman's breast, I mean, should we not be thinking outside of the box or outside of the breast, you know, so to speak, on how is the breast going to be used and what's going to happen here? You know, to me, that goes along with there's no controversy here as far as I'm concerned, but there's certainly a cover-up that continues.
Oh, it does continue, very
absolutely.
Much so. Now, I notice, I mean, I don't know how it is in the States, obviously, but certainly in Canada, there is incredible ignorance, and as you say, you know, a huge cover-up and a fabulous PR job has been done on behalf of Dow Corning by a very top-notch PR company to whitewash the whole thing, as far as I can see, and they've done a very good job. I mean...
Well,
the women are pariahs here. I mean,
right. And
you know.
Lynn, let me point something out to your listeners today in the show is this. Dow Corning and all the manufacturers besides Dow Corning, they certainly were educated, you know, to the fact that first of all, the women, we're going to talk litigation here for a second, that if the women were unable to prove their cases against the manufacturers, And we can certainly, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that's a whole other show, but without the women being able to prove their cases, what the lawyers that represented the women said, then they could not prove their children's cases.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's an endless, you know, if you cannot get represented, the only thing and only rights that we have is to be able to bring litigation against these people to prove our point. And if our own lawyers were selling us out and not being able to help, you know, that's where this, of course, the terminology they started using was junk science. and the only thing I believe and our organization believes is junk is what some of the lawyers and the defense teams for these manufacturers and these huge corporations, corporate greed is there at your finest, of course.
Yeah. Now, obviously, so not very much is being done then to help the children in the States who are suffering from these problems at all. So I noticed that on your website, you know, you do talk about you have got some stuff posted about how the children fell through the cracks in the litigation, and that happened here in Canada too. I mean, in the very initial stages, my law firm was hot to trot. You know, of course, my husband was even named as a plaintiff, I think, in my suit, and certainly my children were. And then suddenly, poof, it's just like they fell off the merry-go-round somehow, and no one talks about it anymore. What happened?
Well, basically, Elaine, what happens, and, you know, I think I have become, or my new bumper sticker that I tell everyone reads Professional Skeptic. Basically, you know, it takes money to make the world go round. And even the best laid plans and best advice of our counselors, our litigators that we hire for law firms, and there were only three. And I would like to tell your listeners, you know, to bring out who those three were, at least in the United States. It was Jeff White, John White, and Al Levin were the only three that were fighting along with Ms. Russano for the rights of the children. And they were the only ones opposing the plan at the time. And, you know, if it had not been for the three attorneys, there would not even be one domestic breast implant product liability attorney at the hearing that you're talking about in Louisiana that would have been there for the rights of the children. But what happens, Elaine, is that the large manufacturers, Dow Corning, Dow Chemical, even though the primary other three, Bristol-Myers Squibb, 3M, and Baxter International, they're going to join forces with Dow Corning to prove that all of the women and to run these lawyers and as far as, you know, money-wise, that they're finally going to try to put their firms out of business. So, of course, Mr. White, they have not. You know, he's still absolutely out there a mouthpiece against Dow Chem, as you well know. He's the only advocate that we have at this time, White & Meany, a law firm in Reno, Nevada, that is saying that Dow Chemical has a definite liability in this. And, you know, but the whole truth runs back to it's all about the money. And if they can run a law firm out of that, then we have no one to represent the children. Even though their intent and their heart would be where we feel it would be, it still takes money to be able to do this.
Well, I know here in Canada, certainly my experience with my lawyers in this was, you know, all this sort of hype, you know, oh, we'll fight them on the beaches and we'll, you know, we'll go in the ring with Dow Chemical, and we're very confident that Dow Chemical is totally, like you say, liable in this, not just Dow Corning, and they have an awful lot of money and we're going to, you know, get you compensation. And basically, I they just folded their tent. I mean...
Well, there's one comment. In fact, Ms. Russano, when she was down in Louisiana at those hearings, in fact, those took place the week of June 28, 1999, that you're talking about, the Louisiana class action. And Jama made a comment to me, and that we even have it on one of our websites, the comment that she made. She said that Dow Chemical had settled all their cases in New Orleans and a large majority of their Texas cases. And she said that she asked Michael Jackson, of Dow Corning's PR person then, said, if you can settle all these cases, why can't you take care of the children? And what Mr. Jackson said back to her, he said, well, there's no science to prove the children's cases. And the children, he said, were not worth their time nor their money. So I think that sums up what Mr. Jackson and Dow Corning and Dow Chemical think about children.
Very arrogant, I
Very arrogant.
Say. Very arrogant. Now, talking about the science, in the last few years, you know, we've seen a great deal, many publications have come out with the science that apparently was always there, but was sort of... buried in the mid-80s, right? Disappeared
right.
from the
right.
libraries. And,
or sooner, was it buried?
That's right, yeah. And then, you know, we had all these sort of studies that were funded by the corporations and were, you know, he who crafts the questions, right,
right.
gets the appropriate answer. And so anyway, these publications, ironically enough, the best ones are actually being published in Europe, because I guess there's such a lot of political pressure here and such a lot of money riding on this for the corporations that you can't get those books here very easily, can you?
No, you cannot. And when you can, they're very, very expensive. Certainly some of the larger law firms have those. When I talk about ATLA, the Association, American Association of Trial Attorneys of America, the arm of that looked at breast implant litigation specifically was called BILG, B-I-L-G, the Breast Implant Litigation Group. And there were about 476 some law firms that belonged to that organization, and they were able and to get these books and to be able to get some of them out that you know, to their big lawyers with big firms that were absolutely going to look to litigate some of the breast implant cases against some of the viable three, Bristol against 3M, McGann 3M, and Bristol-Myers and Baxter. And so they did have access to some of them, and the books that you're referring to, Elaine, as you well know, the documented cases of correlation of disease process were there across the board, that silicone is an adjuvant. It stimulates the immune system. And, you know, that's real simple. That we all know what that does. It pulls our environmental trigger. None of us should have had breast implants. That's what we're looking at today. So we're going to have to reinvent it to be diagnosed on an exam table instead of a courtroom.
Yes, it really is. It really is disgusting. It's very shakes your confidence in humanity somewhat.
Well, it shakes our confidence that I think not only, and you know, I look at being female and being treated as a woman and being a medical professional myself. One of the things that I noted as director of oncology for years looking at medical records, and now also I'm also a legal nurse consultant. I do not work for any law firm specifically, but I am hired out to work as a breast implant specialist in what I do over the years. And when I'm reviewing medical records, I get a little bit of a chuckle at what have I read. It'll say, well-dressed Caucasian female. It starts out well-educated, and I'm always laughing because with men, they never describe that they're balding, fat, or how they look, or how much money they have when they go to a doctor's office. So I find it quite amusing that all of them start out that way about how educated we are and what we're doing. And as a breast implant injured consumer myself, my medical records, I think I'd like to produce a book someday. It talked about me being on the Lisa show and what all I was going to do. And I used to ask, well, what did that have to do with my ruptured silicone gel breast implants and the migration of the gel within them? I don't think it had anything to do with how I was dressed or how intelligent I was.
No, well, I've been very badly treated by the medical fraternity and sort of had threatening words said to me and all kinds of dreadful things, and as have a lot of other women, you know. They don't do it to me now because, you know, now I have access to the radio show. I can play
them. That's right. We can talk about them. And one of the things, Elaine, that I tell when we're, of course, listed with the FDA, the Center of Devices, our organization is, and thank goodness the FDA here in the United States does refer us women that are thinking about breast implants. It does give us a chance for our staff to discuss with them, you know, to send them information on confirmed, documented things to ask their doctors. And one of the things, or two questions, that we have anyone thinking about breast implants or that have been told that breast implants do not cause a problem, we tell them, ask them to do two things. One is we ask, if a woman has had breast implants, then doctor, tell me what the chemical composition of the silicone and the toxins that were in my breast implants. And, of course, that's a trade secret, so it's a trick question because the doctor cannot tell them that. But then we say, number two, if you're saying, doctor, that breast implants do not cause a problem, would you please take out your prescription pad, date it, write what you just told me, and sign it, and hand me that so that I can come back to you if I ever have any problems. So we don't see those two things happening after we encourage them to ask those two questions. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Missouri, we're the only other state in the United States that have an informed consent law on being implanted. And certain information that we have by law has to be provided to anyone thinking about breast implants at least 5 days before a surgery. And at least it gives a woman time to get the FDA booklet in their hand, a package insert, to give time to ask questions. And, of course, our physicians here in the state of Missouri rebel against it all the time. But it is helpful, and we're hoping to set up to be able to have at least a system to be able to go back and look to find out what problems as a registry is what we're hoping for next year.
Well, virtually nothing is being done in Canada. We're not getting any diagnostic tests at all. And I remember you telling me that your husband actually invented a test for the presence of platinum in spinal fluid, because what happens is, of course, the platinum is used as a catalyst in the manufacture of the gel. And, of course, when the breast implants rupture, then, you know, against your chest wall, then some of that silicon finds its way into your spinal column. And am I right?
Well, you're right on one hand. He did not invent it, but interesting enough, the story is when I kept having problems, and we did not, they thought I had MS, they thought I had...
Exactly the same as me.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's okay that they thought that I had all of this, that when I had my lumbar puncture and they looked at my spinal fluid, it was my husband. I almost divine intervention, so to speak, that asked the radiologist if we could split the sample. And he located a lab back in 1996 at that time that would be able to take my spinal fluid to look at it, to do an infrared scan, or to look to see what peaked out of it, and polydimethyl siloxane is what peaked out. Now, the platinum issue is a very, very interesting issue right now today, but Dr. Lakisa, with Baylor, his group, and also another one up in Minnesota, was looking specifically at the platinum, which you're absolutely right is the catalyst that did the curing, and it's in our silicone gel, and that's what they're testing women. We're seeing it in tissue. We're seeing the platinum and silicones in spinal fluid, ovaries, uterus. Forensically, we're seeing it in brain. We're seeing it all over. And now what we're wanting to do is to look and to see, is it now also, which we have confirmed cases, we have two in our files of it being in bone marrow, platinum in bone marrow. And we are taught in nursing to kiss everything, to keep it simple, stupid. And so I'm not trying to step over anyone's head on this, but platinum should not be in your tissue, should not be in your spinal fluid, should not be in these things. We use a chemotherapy agent called cisplatin or platinol that we even treat testicular carcinoma in young men, and some of the major side effects are loss of hair, ringing of the ears, and cardiac problems. And we see this in a large majority of our breast implant recipients.
Mm. Well,
and so, you know, that set off the chain of reaction in some of these wonderful scientists to say, well, let me look to see if we see platinum in the breast implant, not only in the gel, but in the shell of the implant, the envelope of the implant. So, you know, sad enough, I hate to tell all your listeners out there that people with saline breast implants are not perfectly safe. You have a silicone shell around that saline breast implant, and we also see, Elaine, our own type of plethora of problems with saline recipients also.
Yeah, but as you say, that's a whole different program.
It is. That's a whole nother different program.
Right.